Welcome to Street Knowledge with Chris Graham.
Welcome to the podcast. It's Thursday, and I'm finally around to get Rod Mullins on here to talk about last weekend's racing at Bristol. My travel schedule with basketball had me away for a while, it feels like. So we're finally here to talk about Bristol. And Rod, man, you know, I didn't get to see the race, but I did read, what was it, 54 lead changes? What kind of lead? That sounds like a lot going on there. Tell us what was going on there.
Oh, there was just so much going on with this race. It was just unbelievable what all was going on with this race. Not only did we have those lead changes, but I guess the big thing that came out of it was the tires more than anything else. The surface, totally different from what it was on Saturday when they had the truck race. And of course they had the truck race at 8 o'clock at night. So big difference there. Of course it's cooled down. It's not too, you know, it's not got a lot of sun in it. It's got a lot of heat, I should say, but, the trucks didn't have really as much trouble as the cup cars. And when the cup cars got out there, probably at most, maybe about 40 some laps, some were stretching it to about 47, sometimes 50 laps. But you could really tell with the veterans, you could tell that some of the veterans were like pulled back and they didn't want to race as hard because I think it was going to wear the tires out quicker. And the younger ones, they went crazy. They were the ones that just had hammer down, let's go. And then within probably 10, 15 laps after maybe getting new tires, boom, and the cords would be showing on the inside of it. It was a race to remember. A lot of people have said it's probably one of the best Bristol races they've seen in a long, long time. I have to agree. There's some people said, no, there'll never be racing like there was at Bristol back in the 90s. But now I disagree with that. I thought that Sunday's race was not one of these races of who's going to be out in front and who can outrun everybody else in the pack. It was a matter of how well do you treat your equipment? How well do you go and, you know, nurse that car, knowing all these things are going on, these factors, and then get it across the finish line ahead of everybody else and stuff that's having trouble too. So it kind of equaled out the racing surface, so to speak.
I think I also read that Goodyear made the in-race decision to issue, was it one more set of tires for each team?
Yes. Yeah. They issued one more set. At the rate they were going early in the race, they got there, and I think the fear was they were going to run out of tires. And so NASCAR talked to them about it. I think that all came about right after, at the point where Kyle Busch came on the radio and heard him in the media center. He came on in the radio in the media center, and there he was. And he said, I need to know what's wrong with the tires. He said, is it the resin? What is it? Because he says, you know, we're using up tires is what we're doing. And it wasn't long after that, Goodyear came into the media center, and it was a frenzy when people got in there. The Goodyear rep came in there, and I kind of listened to it because the pack was just so big around him. And I just listened to it. And the main thing was, we're not really sure what caused these tires to be this way. This is the same tire they used in the fall of 2023 at the playoff race, but something was different about it. And the only thing that I can kind of put a finger on with this, Kyle Busch may have been right. It may have had something to do with the resin, because the resin was new this year. It wasn't the PJ1 compound they put down in years past. And this resin was supposed to go and allow these cars to keep that on their tires and then be able to move up the track for a little bit better traction up through the rest of the race. But we only had one groove. That's all we had. If you passed, you were taking a chance, especially on the there on the front and the back stretch, and you had to have tires. If you didn't have tires, you weren't going to make the pass, and you didn't make the pass going into the turn, although a couple of them, you know, did make that pass and got around some of them. But I think they were scared to death, afraid that they were going to lose tires and lose them so fast. NASCAR pretty much went ahead and said to Goodyear, hey, what about allotting some different tires or another set of tires out? And they did so. And fortunately, everybody, you know, came up with the same amount of tires after they began to make adjustments.
That's interesting, man. Just the stuff that a lot of fans probably don't think about when they're out there racing, when they're watching a racing. So our favorite, and I think America's favorite driver, won this race. I mean, boy, I tell you what, Denny Hamlin, he is so popular with the fans. He won the race. What was it like a post race with the always gracious Denny Hamlin having won the race?
Humble. I think he knew that he had won a race, trying to quote probably the little nursery rhyme. He won that race by the hair of his chinny chin chin is what he did, because if it hadn't been for this tire issue, I think there'd been several drivers that would have probably contended for the lead, maybe even won the race. Martin Truex was one of those. He had his best finish in, gosh, I don't know how many Bristol starts, but he had one of his best finishes, top 10, top five, I think is what he ended up having. But, he was really kind of subdued that night. He was kind of the attitude. He and Chris Gabehart and Joe Gibbs were there in the media center, and Chris Gabehart was the first to speak as Denny Hamlin was taking care of all of his other duties in Victory Lane. Chris Gabehart got there and he said, I think it's very unfair for people to go and for you all to immediately jump on the fact that this is Goodyear's fault. He said, this is not Goodyear's fault. He says, they came here with a tire. He said, this more than anything else was a test of a driver and a test of the team more than anything. And then Denny Hamlin came into the pits, and Denny Hamlin was like, yeah, we had to race. We had to learn how to race. It wasn't just opening it up and then putting the foot down to the floorboard and taking off around the track. We were having to go and conserve and having to go and use things and use them wisely before we used them up out on the track. He was very humble afterwards. He said that, he was thankful for the win, no doubt about it. But of course, with the fans and so forth, he kind of ate up that a little bit. He held up the number one as he faced the fans there on the front stretch. But he was a different bird when he came into the media center, and I think he was very much of the realization that yes, he was very lucky that he got through this race without any kind of scratch, any kind of rubbed for the wrong way or anything like that, or major damage, sort of like what William Byron and some of the others ran into in this race, losing tires, breaking the tow bar and things like that. It ended their day early, William Byron and company.
What was I've just spent the last 2 weeks in the media bubble for basketball, ACC tournament, NCAA tournament, and it's always cool being back behind the scenes there, and you hear the scuttlebutt from the other writers. So I have to ask you, because I've been hearing basketball talk for 2 weeks, what was the talk? What was the behind the scenes stuff being talked about in the media center there at Bristol this weekend?
Well, besides the tires on Sunday, there were some of the rumors going around about whether or not Honda is going to make their appearance into NASCAR. It seems like the groundswell is starting to increase a little bit more. No official word on it just yet. Then there was the talk. There was this strange thing going around that Dale Earnhardt Jr. might be making an appearance at North Wilkesboro for the All-Star race. Now, I don't know if that's going to happen or not. I do know that there was a big announcement scheduled for the Dale Jr. Download, which happened to be a tribute car. Chase Elliott's going to be driving a tribute car for Dale Jr. When they go to Darlington, part of the throwback weekend that they usually have. And it's going to be in the National Guard colors that Earnhardt rode and drove around in, for several years there. That was some of it. The other thing I believe was the crowd. Everybody was asking about the crowd, and they went back to, in one way, it was almost like 90s pricing in a way for some of these tickets. And still we didn't have a crowd that filled the stadium and filled up the racetrack. And it's left me wondering, what in the world does Bristol have to do to get these fans back? Now, you pile some people in there in the late fall, especially with that playoff race. So now here's the question. You move this race. We got by lucky. We had good weather for that particular day for the race weekend. Had great weather on that Saturday in practice, and it didn't wear the tires out or anything on practice on Saturday, but here they are on Sunday and they're tearing the tires up. But there's a lot of people asking the question, what do we do? What does Bristol Motor Speedway do? What does NASCAR do? Because it could have been a snowy weekend. We could have had snow. We were just blessed we didn't have it. That's one big question. I think there's another big question right now circulating if whether or not Speedway Motorsports will have enough pull and get North Wilkesboro back on the track and back on the schedule, at least in one capacity or another. I know they're talking about the clash that's been out in Los Angeles. They're intending on moving that from the Coliseum, and of all places, they're looking at what's that famous little place out there in Los Angeles? I think it's the Bums play. Oh, Brooklyn Dodgers, the LA Dodgers, I should say. Uh-huh. They're thinking about using Dodger Stadium for the next race, but now that's still kind of up in the air at this point. I think one thing that would probably bring some crowds into Bristol, maybe, just maybe, I don't know if it would work or not, is to have a clash there. Sort of similar to what they're having out on the West Coast, but have one on the East Coast, and especially at Bristol, and it be a part of a clash weekend, say, as they make their way back across the country to get ready for Daytona. But, you know, logistics is going to play a part of it. I really, at this point, can't figure out. I'm kind of scratching my head wondering what can Bristol do and what can NASCAR do to get some of these fans back. And I can tell you this. One thing that a lot of the fans would say, well, you should go turn around and resurface it with concrete, get that groove back up there at the top that they had for so many years. Yeah, but that's not going to happen anytime soon. I don't see that happening. The next thing is Kyle Larson kind of turned a troll loose on me this past week. I had posted something on one of the pages. Kyle Larson wasn't happy with the tire situation on Sunday. And he said, I just don't like Bristol. And I'm like, okay, you didn't like Bristol on dirt last year, but you said you'd rather have it back on concrete. So now we've got it back on concrete, and you're complaining now that it's just not Bristol, it's the tires. It wasn't fun this time around. And I called Kyle Larson a Goldilocks driver. I said, you know, it's either too hot, it's too cold. No, this one's just right. And then I got somebody that went on one of these pages. I don't know who it was, but they had, of all things, Chris, they'd snapped a picture or taken a picture from, must have been from my Facebook page, and it was of you and Crystal, of all things.
Okay.
And I don't know if they thought I was you or whatever uh-huh. the situation was, but then they told me to shut the, well, we'll just leave it at that and stuff. And I was referred to as a body part on the rear side of the body. We'll just call it a hole, for example. Uh-huh. And I was like, I'm just stating a purpose. I'm just stating, you know, the opinion about the whole thing. You know, if you're going to complain, you better be prepared to back it up with the reason why you're going to complain about it. And all I said was, he's a Goldilocks driver. He just likes it. Track's got to be a certain way for him. It's not one of these things of where you race the track regardless to prove what kind of driver you are. And that's where I turn to and I say, Denny Hamlin proved he was probably the better driver and the better coach driver from the pits with Chris Gabehart calling the shots.
Yeah, it's always so weird to me. Social media can be that way that, all right, so you have an opinion, you're expressing your opinion.
Right.
You're paid to develop and express opinions. And so if you don't like the opinion, let's not engage and say, well, why are you calling my Goldilocks driver? I don't think that's fair. You know, it's not that, or someone presenting an alternative argument, it's, you know, call names.
Yeah.
That's what the world does these days. It is call names, right?
Right. And, you know, the other thing is they wrap themselves in the American flag and also shake their Constitution of the United States in front of everybody's face and say, I've got First Amendment rights to freedom of speech. No, you don't have freedom of speech. Not the way that you're thinking you've got freedom of speech. There's nothing that says in that Constitution you have the freedom to be ignorant. And that's what a lot of these people are, I think, sometimes. And I'm meaning that in a serious way, because there are some people that get into, as we would refer to, and I'll try to keep it as family as much as I can on this program. There are too many people that decide they want to get involved in a pissing match. Uh-huh. And this is what ends up happening. And, you know, I was just like, you know, do you think that you can say anything without cussing me out on here? All I was doing was just stating an opinion from my perspective. Oh, I never got an answer back on it. So it's one of those things where the trolls just run rampant, it seems like, in social media and out in cyberspace. And it's one of those things that I should have known it was going to be out there. Somebody was going to get mad about it. But, you know, hey, to each his own. That's the way I feel about it.
Yeah, the people who trumpet the First Amendment also don't realize that the First Amendment is just a protection from the government taking your speech rights away.
Exactly.
If Augusta Free Press says you can't comment on that story anymore because you're an a-hole, I'm not the government, so right. I can take away your quote unquote freedom of speech from that standpoint. I mean, and you don't want to do that, but at the same time, you also, you know, I guess I've been lucky in the last several months. A really good, strong group of 50 plus people who email me about UVA athletics, and it's they email good questions, sometimes good observations, and then we have discussions about them. And sometimes it makes me learn, and sometimes maybe I'm help them learn. And I usually post a lot of those as mailbag items, I call them. Mm-hmm. But nobody's calling anybody names. Nobody's saying anybody's stupid or you're a poopy head or anything like that. Yeah, we can all learn from each other, or we can just be trolls. And the trolls, you know, honestly, Rod, the hard thing is, our jobs get us in front of people, and you want to engage with people, but mm-hmm. you don't want to engage with the trolls. They just want to live under their bridge.
Yeah, that's it. That's what they want to do. And, you know, surprisingly, a couple of people came to me, especially this past week, talking about Scott's little observations about whether or not UVA should have made the tournament and everything with basketball. And I was like, the whole thing, I agree. I don't think they should have made the tournament, because I think it was a little bit of an embarrassment, so to speak. And then it really came out the other night of the ball game. And, you know, I'm like, I just don't think this team was ready. And then I think there was another article that you may have put out, or it may have been Jerry that put it out or something, about the fact of, you know, I think everybody's kind of figured this card out now about the offense. The offense, you know, just is no good, has not been good. You know, something's got to be done. And it's kind of like they've languished almost in a way, it seemed like the whole season. But nobody during the whole time ever referred to you as anything derogatory or anything like that. They were like, you know, the guy that you do some work for and stuff, hey, right on target with stuff, you know, exactly some of these questions that I've been asking. And nobody else has seemed to address them too much except for you or Scott or something like that. So it's a little bit of a compliment to you guys too.
I did call Scott a chuckle bum, which is a made up insult. And it was because I wrote a column where I said he was wrong to say that Virginia didn't deserve an NCAA tournament bid, only because the day of the selection show, which was, you know, it's Sunday at 6 o'clock, whatever time it is, during the day, nothing else to do, because, you know, there's until 6 o'clock. If you're a college basketball fan, you got nothing to do. So I analyzed the 16 teams that Joe Lunardi, the ESPN guy, said were most on the bubble, last eight teams in, the first eight teams out. And I did an analysis of those resumes based on the criteria the NCAA Tournament Selection Committee supposedly uses: computer rankings and strength of schedule and road record and quadrant wins. Mm-hmm. And when I looked at that, I said, hey, Virginia's in the field. They're one of the top eight teams of those 16. So Virginia should have been, and there were others, you know. So now, of course, they lose the game, and oh, you see, mm-hmm. that proved they should have not gotten in.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are going to be 16 teams that lose today and 16 that lose tomorrow. Should they have not been in? I mean, you know, so
exactly.
So that said, you know, yeah, I call Scott a chuckle bum, but also I published his story because, you know, I knew that there were certainly a lot of people who thought that way, and he gave good arguments for why he thought the way he did. So. You know, so at least I backed up Chuckle Bum, you know,
I mean, I thought it was nice that they got the invite. I'll just say it that way. I was just afraid it was going to be, well, exactly like what I saw the other night, you know, what little bit I saw. I think I flipped it on, got over there, and I saw the score at 18-14, and UVA was horrible on rebounding. And I was just like, nah, I don't think this is going to happen. And then right before I went to bed, I looked at the score. I said, yep, that one's sealed up. At least we don't have to worry about this one and going on and then getting embarrassed again. But, you know, I like the story that came out this past, I guess it was today. And there is a team that is using UVA's example of what happened to them sort of like what happened last year, or the year, the first year that Virginia, after they made the national tournament and made the and won the championship, Purdue is looking at that same kind of aspect of the way that they should play their basketball going into this and say, be prepared for anything. Let's be on top of things and stuff. Know that anybody on a given night could knock anybody out of this. And I think Purdue's chances are probably good going into this tournament, but you know, everything else in this 64 team field is just like crazy. You just never know who's going to pull off an upset before it's over with.
Yeah, and there's so much parity in college basketball now because of the transfer portal, because of NIL, that, yeah, a lot of teams can win that. But, you know, you got to turn the TV off the other night, Rod. I couldn't do that. I was sitting in that arena.
Sit there. You had to sit there. You had to
and
sit
I'm
there
directly,
and take
I was on the floor directly across from the Virginia bench. So not only did I have to, you know, not only sit there and couldn't leave, but I had to look and see how sad Tony Bennett looked the whole second half.
Gosh.
I think it may have been you and I were talking about this last week, how Tony, it was me and somebody were talking about how Tony has seemed to be more fiery this year. You know, he got the technical foul in a game not too long ago. He's been more fired up with his team. When they went through that stretch missing 19 straight shots, even Tony, who's been as fired up as I've seen him in years, he sat on the bench most of the second half. There was nothing he could do. He couldn't fire his team up, and it's hard, you know. You know, we were all in the arena like that. It was tough. I mean, you know, days like that happen, but you know, that's just part of sports, you know, just like there with you in Bristol. I mean, you know, sometimes it's your day and sometimes it's not. But when you're on the NASCAR Cup Series level, when you're NCAA Division I, NCAA tournament level, it happens in front of a lot of people, and there's no hiding from that. Unfortunately.
Well, for me, I think on Sunday afternoon, I was kind of looking at Ty Gibbs. Ty Gibbs was running awfully well right there at one point, won two of the three stages, and looked at it and thought, you know, hey, I think this could be Ty Gibbs's day. This could be his day that he pulls out this win and so forth. But then he fell into the youth trap, and that was overdrove his car. And then he had nothing else to give of that car, although he did come back from like about 16th or 17th and managed to kind of weed his way through the field to get up to about as high as fourth or fifth, I think, at one point, maybe even third. And then by that time, he had already drove the wheels off of it, and then he had nothing else to give. And it's like, hey, you've got to conserve. We've only got so many sets of tires in here. You've got to conserve. And so I think that was one of those learning experiences for a young driver out there. Oh, by the way, I was going to mention to you too, I don't know if you saw the news this evening. Did you see where NASCAR is going to take over the operations and the racing operations at Bowman Gray Stadium?
No, I didn't know. I didn't see that.
Yeah, they just announced it probably a couple of hours ago and stuff. Okay. They made an announcement about it. Ben Kennedy with NASCAR, who's one of the higher ups, of course, in the France family too. And he made the announcement that they are going to take over operations of Bowman Gray Stadium. And I think that's going to be tremendous. You know, that's a all-purpose facility, so to speak. They play football there on Friday nights, or they have in the past. And then they have on Saturday nights, they have late model stock car racing. So now what does that mean? I don't know. At this point, I think it's probably something of getting back to the roots sort of thing, maybe with NASCAR trying to appeal to a smaller group in a smaller area to try to pull more people in and stuff to be able to come to a race. I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see how they're going to pull this off. Who knows? It might be a site for a clash race, might even be a one for the all-star race. Who knows what they're going to go and do with this, but sounded very interesting when I heard the announcement this afternoon.
Yeah. To see that is interesting, you know, as much as NASCAR has moved into, you know, as many big markets as possible and all that, yeah, you got to make sure to take care of your grassroots as well.
Yeah.
And this kind of thing, you know, getting a North Carolina track, Winston-Salem, right there in the heart of it all. Yeah, that can be the kind of thing that can just, you know, kind of give a change there. And, you know, and Just like in, I mean, I'm thinking baseball as an example, even college basketball. I was recently in the Cameron Indoor Stadium at Duke. There's all these glittering brand new arenas in big cities, and those small venues, the Cameron Indoors, the Fenway Parks in baseball, Wrigley Fields, and that kind of thing. There's iconic places like that that do well too, business wise, but they're not the glitzy brand new McMansion type racetracks and all that kind of stuff. So we got to cover all those bases and make sure we give fans a lot of different looks to want to be a part of it.
Yeah, and I think they also need to go and appeal to a different group of fans too. I think that was another thing of talk down there at the race at Bristol of who they have attracted. I know that there were some friends that I had on Facebook that were there, and they put up that this isn't the same NASCAR. This isn't the same NASCAR racing that I grew up on. And of course it's not. It's not the same kind of NASCAR that I followed through the late 80s and all through the 90s and so forth. It's just not there. But then you have drivers that come in like Kobayashi, the one that's from Japan that's going to be racing at COTA this weekend down in Texas. And he gets there during, he comes to Bristol. He wants to see what all the excitement is about with Bristol. And he feels like to him, NASCAR has a better shot of getting him involved in racing more so than Formula One. That kind of surprised me. And then somebody asked him, why? Why would you go with NASCAR over Formula One? He says, NASCAR, he says, in the best way he can, trying to explain it was, NASCAR, you can have some fun with it. Formula One, you're still out there and everything is so dictated, as the way he put it. Everything is dictated a certain way. And if you don't do it a certain way, then you pretty much have to take your toys up and just leave and go. And Michael Andretti and his attempt to get into Formula One was just met at the door almost with an immediate slam into Formula One. So, some of these teams are trying to branch out in some different places. Kobayashi, on the other hand, he wants it to branch out and go back to Japan. They raced there, I think, in the late 80s or 90s. I think it was maybe in the 90s when they went to there to Suzuki, Japan, and they raced on a actual race car track similar to COTA. And the Japanese loved it. And it's like, why haven't they ever come back? Well, economic things and different things like that with the sport. But Kobayashi thinks the potential is there that NASCAR could become a more recognized world sport, sort of along the lines of what IndyCar was at one point or another, pulling these F1 drivers in. That's what he thinks is happening. So here he is, IndyCar driver coming in this weekend to race at COTA. And, he's looking forward to it. He says, I think I'm more prepared for COTA than I was for the Indianapolis 500 last year. And he said, I think it shows. I think we're going to be prepared. And I think we're going to do well this coming weekend at COTA.
It would surprise me if the folks who run NASCAR aren't and haven't been for years thinking, boy, if we could, make this international somehow, have different circuits, have a NASCAR Japan circuit, have a NASCAR Australia circuit, that kind of thing. And then hey, that be one, it would be good to expand the business. The only way to expand the business would be to, create those new circuits. And also, hey, you can find some talent out there. And maybe eventually get them to the main NASCAR circuit, as it were. You could create a World Series of racing. I mean, there's a lot of possibilities there. So hearing that kind of talk makes me think down those lines.
Yeah, it makes me think the same way because I feel like that NASCAR kind of has, kind of gone beyond now the sort of the regional thing. I mean, we still have a love for it just in particular areas in the country. Which matter of fact, I think this past weekend, Food City 500 was the highest rated race all season so far on this young season in NASCAR. I think they had something like 3 million, 3.5 million viewers or something of that nature, which were good numbers for Bristol, even though you had a lot of empty seats. Well, I think a lot of people stayed home. They just wanted to watch the race at home and they got a good race, no doubt about it. But still, it's opening that up. And then what does the future hold? I mean, you've got the broadcast rights now. Oh, here's the other thing that they were talking about in the pits too. I can't think of the guy's name, but he has done the IndyCar races and some Formula One racing for off and on, but he's done the Indy 500 race for NBC here in the past several years. They are going to be replacing Rick Allen, who has been the lead on most of the NASCAR races here since NBC got him back. And they're going to replace him with this guy who a lot of fans are starting to say, what does he know about NASCAR? Well, I know he knows a lot about racing, no doubt about it, but it's a British voice. It's a British voice. And they say NBC is getting ready to turn everything upside down when it comes to their coverage and what they're going to be doing. I don't know if it's going to be aimed at a more at a greater worldwide audience, what they're going to try to appeal to with this. I don't know. But, you know, Dale Jr. is not a part of that anymore. And Dale Jr. has had to come out and tell people, hey, you know, it wasn't anything that I couldn't do, or it wasn't that they wouldn't let me do this. We just came to the end of the contract and I just, you know, I couldn't get an agreement. So I've moved on, and that's what I'm going to do. And that's what he's going to end up going with on the Amazon and the WB coverage on some of these things. And it also keeps him close to home. He doesn't have to go and travel these 15 or so races toward the end of the year and so forth, and then risk something like what happened at Bristol here a couple of years ago with that plane crash and something happening to him. You know, I think he just wants to stay close to home. He wants to be close to the girls, his wife. You know, what else better reason for some of these drivers to stay close to family and be able to stay close to them like that? And I think Dale Jr. probably sees that, and he doesn't want to end up being in a career that kind of took him down that road with his dad, and also the way his relationship was, Kelly and Dale Jr. and so forth, Carrie also in that mix, that they didn't really know their dad all that well until after they got a little bit older. And then they started understanding a little bit more about him as he kind of was mellowing a little bit more as he got older. I think that kind of told the tale. So Dale Jr. is trying, I think, to really learn from past mistakes made in the family, and trying to go and do something in that regard to be a little bit more of a family man, close to home kind of guy, I think.
This is the kind of stuff that we really get when we go cover stuff like, you know, your weekend in Bristol, mm-hmm. my weekend, my last couple weeks in ACC and NCAA tournaments. People think we're there to cover the games or the races, and you are, but also mm-hmm. you get all this insight. So that's why we need to do this podcast. And I'm glad we were able to finally get it in here. And you've got another race coming up that you're going to be covering in Martinsville in a couple of weeks.
Right. Going to be going to Martinsville. We've got one couple more races here. We've got COTA this weekend down in Texas, Austin, Texas, the biggest track on the circuit right now because it's a big, huge road course. And then on Easter Sunday, going to be close to you. Well, actually, not that far. Richmond, they're going to be in town for Richmond for Easter Sunday. And then that next following weekend, we'll be making the trip across on 58 and then up and down and around to Martinsville and going to Martinsville Speedway for the first time. That's going to be neat. I drove by it before. I drove by it when I worked there for a time being when I was working in Henry County Schools, and I always wanted to go to a race there, and I never did get a chance to. And then now the doors opened up that we're going to have a chance to get some coverage of Martinsville. And it'll be my first race. My son's going with me to do some photography also. And he gets a big kick out of going to these races for the first time. He loved going to the Roval race in North Carolina at Charlotte that first year. Loved going to the 600 race here a couple of years ago. So this is going to be an adventure for him too, because you're going to be in a lot more tighter corners and circles than you are at those particular tracks, especially at Charlotte, because Charlotte's so big, it's kind of spread out a little bit. At Martinsville, they don't call it the big paperclip for nothing. I mean, it's just that tight, the way that the track is. But I'm sure we're going to see some really good racing by the time we get to Martinsville.
Well, we'll look forward to that. Of course, when we come back next week, we'll cover Circuit of the Americas. We'll get you ready for Richmond, and then we're not too far off from Martinsville. Hey, great discussion. Thank you, Rod, as always, for your time and your insight.
Appreciate it, Chris. Thanks.